For spooktacular.
Woo!
Woo!
Yay!
I feel like we need some sort of special, like confetti or something.
Fireworks or something to put on the screen. Especially since my goofy hat isn't here yet. Anyway, this is good.
What? Oh, yes, we're going to wear hats.
Yeah.
I have this hat. Here, let me put this hat on. It has like a witch's cat on it.
The only one I have is a baseball cap that I showed Jen that is Bigfoot and an alien on it. So
there. Okay, I'm now ready.
All right, yay.
I look like a crone and a weirdo.
At least somebody is festive. I got my Universal Monsters.
It doesn't match my shirt, but you know.
It's celebratory. So episode 100. Okay. On October 23rd, 2020, we welcomed you to our first hometown haunt. Now, a little over 3 1/4 years later, we are celebrating our 100th episode. We've pulled out all the stops, yes, to celebrate with this spooktacular show, sharing more of your hometown haunts and doing a deep dive into your most requested topic, Bobby Mackey's Music World.
Woohoo!
We did so much research for this episode that we're cutting it into two, just keeping the party going for 2 weeks instead of one. The first is the history of the property with a murder mystery of Pearl Bryan and mob ties to the location. Part two covers from 1978 to present day Bobby Mackey's. So we got a two-parter for everyone. One of our very rare two-parters. So, on with the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the 100th episode, our spooktacular, of the Hometown Haunts podcast. I am your host, Kat Cloco, and along with me for 3 1/4 years doing this show are my co-hosts, Christina Wald and Jen Kohler.
Yay!
Yay!
Yay! And I'm still recovering from bronchitis, so none of the really funny voices from me today. I still sound like Muttley when I laugh. But...
No, I think you need to say we're about to do some.
Yeah.
We're about to play some hot tracks from.
Yeah, everyone has said I've voiced my concern over how my voice sounds because in my head it sounds super rocky. And everyone's like, no, you sound like one of those late night radio DJs.
Yeah.
I'm like, do I?
Okay. A little bit, yeah.
I'll work with that. So our news, just very quickly, because my goodness, Bobby Mackey's is deep and it's deep and long. It's like 10 pages. It's like 10 pages of research. This was by far and away our most requested location we have not covered yet for the show. When we would do live events like this past October, you guys got inundated by questions about Bobby Mackey's. And I know in previous live events or going to conventions, people are like, have you heard about this place called Bobby Mackey's? And I'm just like, yes, I have. But I've been there. And so have you, Jen, correct?
Yes.
And we can talk about our experiences after I'm done. But I have done a deep dive. As you said, Christina, it looks like, what is it, a book report?
Research paper.
A research paper, which those are apparently how I like to spend my Sundays. But in reality, I spent the past 2 weeks, 3 weeks of me recovering from bronchitis, couldn't really talk. So I just watched everything that had Bobby Mackey's in it that I could get.
Awesome.
So I have watched close to like 45 hours worth of content. I have four different books with Bobby Mackey's in it. One book is all about Bobby Mackey's.
Wow.
I feel like I live in Bobby Mackey's now.
Wow.
I mean, I knew it was popular, but I didn't realize it was that well known, I guess.
This is an interesting little, I noticed waves of interest with Bobby Mackey's. depending on when I was watching the content. And it is interesting seeing when it became popular, when it had a resurgence, and then post closer to now when it's brought up in media. How it's represented changes through time. And it's fantastic. As a cultural anthropologist, I'm like, this is a great watching of media and seeing how the approach changes, as ghost hunting was seen as something laughable back in the early 90s to something serious in the aughts. And then now something that is just a regular staple type show in media now in the late 2010s, 2020s. So let's dig into this, because there's a lot of history. And I learned a lot about Northern Kentucky history by reading about this location. So, sources for tonight's show. Ghosts of Bobby Mackey's Music World by Dan Smith. That was the complete book that I have right here. Very good. The Jerry Springer Show, which really surprised me. The WLWT Archives. Ghost Adventures, two different seasons, and there are four different technical episodes or events that happen. Mm-hmm. Ghost Hunters, BuzzFeed Unsolved, Weird Kentucky by Jeff Scott Holland, Cincinnati Ghosts by Karen Lavin, Cincinnati Haunted Handbook by Jeff and Michael Morris, Wikipedia, the Kentucky Post Archive, and the Cincinnati Enquirer Archive. If you note here, I kept to actual media that came out by somewhat reputable sources. I know some people can cough about their opinions about the paranormal shows. That is fine. But I didn't really do a whole lot of internet research from like random websites. Mostly because you get a lot of repetitive stories. What I liked about Ghosts of Bobby Mackey's Music World by Dan Smith was that he has a very long bibliography and cites a whole bunch of stuff, and worked with the Campbell County Historical Society for sourcing a lot of his historical stuff. So as a history nerd, I loved it. So, known as the most haunted hot nightclub, I almost called it a hot tub, in America, Bobby Mackey's Music World has been entertaining generations of country music fans in Wilder, Kentucky since 1978. Besides the country crooning, the establishment is equally well known for being an extremely haunted place, and rumors of it being tied to one of the most haunted true crimes in Kentucky, the murder of Pearl Bryan. Featured on numerous paranormal TV shows, such as I said earlier, Ghost Adventures, twice, Ghost Hunters, The Scariest Places on Earth, BuzzFeed's Unsolved, and even The Maury Povich Show and Jerry Springer, it is one of the most accessible paranormal places for the public to visit, because not right now, but up until last fall, it hosted ghost tours nearly every day. The history of Wilder, Kentucky, and that of Bobby Mackey's Music World is steeped in crime, booze, and blood. As we'll dive into this crazy history of 44 Licking Pike, and those who haunt it, just a word of caution for all our listeners. We dive into a number of very disturbing topics while telling the history of Bobby Mackey's and Newport, Kentucky, that go further than just hauntings. Listener discretion is advised. This is definitely not an episode for young ears or sensitive stomachs. All right. We will see you at the next episode. I hope it won't be quite as graphic. All right. So the early days. Kentucky has been Shawnee, Cherokee, Chickasaw, and Osage land before any French American or British settlers reached the area. That changed when, in 1792, James Taylor Jr., along with three black slaves from his family, Humphrey, Adam, and Moses, arrived at the point where the Licking River meets the Ohio River, now Newport, Kentucky. I say this tiredly because I don't like slavery. At the time, this part of Kentucky was part of Virginia, and the Taylor family had claim to it. The men got to work clearing the land and established farms. In the early 1800s, the Newport Barracks were built to replace Fort Washington, along with Marcus Finch, who was tasked with plotting the land around Newport. The area Finch planned was called Finchtown and later became Wilder, Kentucky. During the Civil War years, heavy sigh here, Northern Kentucky was not the kind of place where African American population could feel safe, freed, or enslaved. There was a lot of social divide when the United States fell into civil war, and Kentucky as a whole stayed neutral, but very divided. 35,000 Kentuckians served the Confederate Army, and 125,000 white Kentuckians served Union, along with 24,000 freed and enslaved black soldiers. Wow. I had no idea that Kentucky sent so many Union soldiers to fight in the Civil War. I also had no idea that they remained neutral. I blame my education from being in a different state and almost very northern, because I came from northern Indiana. Mm-hmm. But I had no idea that Kentucky declared neutrality. I declare neutrality. But their governor was actually a Southern sympathizer. So when Abraham Lincoln had written to him and said, hey, do you mind supplying some men and stuff to the Union cause? He was just like, no, I'm not doing that. But
I'm shocked.
He was just, Abraham did surprise Pikachu face. But still, you had quite a few 100,000 soldiers sign up to be with the Union. However, Finchtown was not one of those places that supported the Union. And there was a strip of land called Gallows Gap that ran from Monmouth Street to Route 27 to the Licking River. This gap was filled with hanging trees, and at least 20 men saw their deaths there in 1865, or by 1865. Mm-mm. This is also when the first stories of hauntings in the area began to circulate. Gallows Gap was so haunted that people feared walking there alone, especially at night, choosing to walk along the rail line that passes through while trains illuminated the path and drowned out the ghostly moans of the hanged men. The property that Bobby Mackey's Music World sits on is at the southwestern end of Gallows Gap, along with the Licking River. Wenzel's Slaughterhouse was established along the Licking River next to the rail line at the southern point of the Bobby Mackey property. However, it was not a commercial slaughterhouse, as it's depicted in almost all media. Instead, Wenzel's was more of a butcher's curing shed. I'm sorry to burst everyone's bubble. It was a tiny little shed. There is a 1800s land grant map that is supplied in the Ghost by Bobby Mackey's Music World and the Gamble County Historical Society that shows this itty bitty little shed just south of what was the building that became Bobby Mackey's. So I was surprised by learning about that. It's the building no longer stands. Sorry, was somebody asking a question?
No, I said it's no Porkopolis.
It's no Porkopolis, no. The curing shed no longer stands. What the nightclub sits on is the 1876 George W. Robson Distillery, which was built on the same piece of property as the current property. At the time, Howell Street divided the parcel of land, and the distillery sat north of it along the river and would be in the Gallows Gap area. And curing shed was just south of it across Howell Street. Three tunnels were built from the river to the distillery, and they served two purposes. The first was to drain rainwater away from the train tracks so they didn't erode away, and the second was to pump water from the Licking River to the distillery. So the portal to hell, as everyone knows of it, is actually an intake tunnel for water to make booze. It is not a portal to hell to whisk, you know, blood, guts, and all sorts of other bits into the Licking River, which I found extremely interesting. The distillery was located. I'm going to try that again. The distillery was located here for 43 years, changing names along the way. Distilleries that used the property were the George W. Robson Jr. and Company Distillery, just rolls off the tongue, the Licking Bourbon Distillery, much more fun, and finally the Old 76 Distillery, which closed its doors in 1919 due to prohibition. The site was never abandoned. Please keep that in mind as I talk about the other stories. However, a lot of traumatic events happened in the late 19th century, post-Civil War, in Newport and Wilder. In 1888, the distillery had an explosion that knocked out a wall and severely burned its night watchman, George Ulrich. In June of 1892, there was a horrific 11th Street bridge collapse that killed 41 men during its construction. The men either drowned in the river, were crushed by falling debris, or in some instances, impaled by girders. Yeah, it was horrific.
Sounds there pleasant.
There are photographs of this. They basically, the 11th Street bridge collapsed. It wasn't sturdily even as it was going across the river. And one carpenter warned another one saying, hey, that girder is not sturdy. It's not sitting correctly. It's super wobbly. It may collapse. And the other one's like, nah, it's good. We're fine. And basically it collapsed, taking out 41 men and injuring quite a few more. There was one woman who lost all three of her sons who were working on the bridge that day.
God, that's awful. So,
yeah. And probably the saddest story. Well, that is a very sad story. All of them are sad stories. But there was a little boy who was bringing his uncle's lunch and learned about his uncle's deaths while watching other people drowning and slowly dying on these girders. And he had to just, instead of like comforting the child and saying, I'm sorry, your uncles have died. Here, let me walk you to your family's home. They just sent him on his way alone to go explain this to his mom.
Oh my gosh.
So it was
a different time. Well, that kid grew up that day.
Sorry?
That kid grew up that day.
Yes, he did. Yeah.
Poor baby.
Yeah. So just a few years later, after that terrible accident, February 1st, 1896 was a dark day in the history of Newport. That is when Pearl Bryan's decapitated body was found in an orchard.
Mm-hmm. This is how I found out about Bobby Mackey's from this story. Wow. Yeah. Jeff at the Enquirer told me about it because he was researching it. Go ahead.
Okay. I was going to say, what do you know about the story? If you could give like cliff notes.
Just basically how she died and how it kind of started in Cincinnati and it went over to Kentucky and that her head, her missing part was never found.
It's her head.
Yes. Well, gone. I didn't want to spoil it.
She's kind of well known for missing a particularly important part of her body.
Yes. And it just, you know, again, men killing women just makes me mad.
Oh yeah. This is not going to help at all quell that anger.
No.
So Pearl was the daughter of Alexander and Susan Bryan, who were wealthy and well-respected farm family in the Greencastle, Indiana. Well, not just in Greencastle, Indiana. An 1892 graduate of Greencastle High School, Pearl was working as a Sunday school teacher when she disappeared in late January 1896. On January 28th, Pearl left her family in Greencastle under the guise that she was visiting a friend in Indianapolis. Instead, she was visiting her boyfriend, Scott Jackson, in Cincinnati, Ohio. They had been dating for a few months, and Jackson was a dental student in Cincinnati and found out recently that Pearl was pregnant when her cousin and Jackson's acquaintance, William Wood, sent a telegram with the news. On the morning of February 1st, 1896, 12-year-old John Hewling was cutting across the property of farmer John Locks, whose farm is located at what is the current Campbell County YMCA in Fort Thomas. It was there that he met a grisly discovery, a decapitated body of a young woman lying in a pool of blood left in a ditch in an orchard. He immediately ran to the Lock family farm and notified Mike Newman, who was a workman on the property. Newman let John Locke know of the discovery, and they notified the Commander Colonel Cochran of Fort Thomas, who then also got Sergeant Phillips of the Newport Police to arrive on the scene, along with Coroner Tingley. So this is a lot of high-up people being immediately called to a murder scene. Crime scene photographs were also taken of the body, which is super interesting because this is 1896. People don't think about them bringing out those large cameras to take photos, but this was a big deal. And we're also super close to Cincinnati and Fort Thomas that have these types of abilities to bring out everything to investigate. They had the resources to do this. Her dress was thrown up over her shoulder, and her corset had been torn from her body, which actually makes me wonder if she was wearing a stay and not a corset, but meh. She was dressed in a green checkered house dress with blue flannel underskirt, black stockings, and cloth top shoes in a size 3. The quality of her dress and clothes were quite cheap, and initially she was suspected of being a sex worker who was visiting the soldiers at Fort Thomas. The coroner looked over her body. A clean clump of red hair was on the victim. Coroner Tingley noted that the woman had been decapitated at the 5th vertebrae with several jagged cuts that changed direction. He wrote, this was written in the newspaper, "The lacerated neck shows that the torture was inflicted with a hand knife or other instrument not sharp enough to overcome the resistance readily," which is noted in the Kentucky Post. Tingley also discovered that the blood splatter traveled as high as 6 feet into the apple orchard trees surrounding the scene and soaked 3 inches deep into the soil around her body, meaning that she was alive when she was decapitated. And I have provided a photo. This is a recreation using a dummy of the scene, how Pearl Bryan's body was found in the orchard. And this is from 1896, which was sold later as a postcard, by the way.
Oh, lovely.
I know.
How wonderful. Weird.
Her body was removed from the scene and taken to undertaker W.H. White in Newport. Two police detectives were dispatched to further investigate the crime scene, Krim and McDormand. Unfortunately, we don't have their first names. When the detectives arrived, they were shocked to find that John Locke, the farm owner, had opened the scene up for gawkers, souvenir hunters, and soldiers from Fort Thomas for a small price. The crowd had stepped on, stepped through, looted, and taken tree branches and even the bloody dirt from the scene. Later, he charged 10 cents for the morbid curious to look at the photos he had taken of the crime scene. However, this came to backfire as the curiosity seekers trampled through his crops, leading him to send gawkers to crime scenes that he said were located elsewhere, away from his crops and property. And I brought, this is a late teens, early 1920s photograph. And it says it's a bunch of people standing next to where the body would have been. And the photo says, "Visiting the scene where Pearl Bryan was murdered, 1896, near Fort Thomas."
Wow.
Curious are forever and eternal here.
I mean, I know Penny Dreadfuls and all that used to do that. And they used to, people over in Europe used to basically, like an amusement park, walk through murder scenes.
Yes.
But it still disturbs me that they did that.
Yeah, it takes dark tourism to a new level.
Yeah.
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 So, well, the sites are not
popular.
Yes. Yeah. Well.
Yes. Bloodhounds were brought from Indiana to search for the victim's head. However, because the crime scene had been tampered with and people had taken bloody soil and branches, the bloodhounds tracked so many scents that it sent 20 men to jail as suspects. In the end, the head was not found by the bloodhound tracking. Identifying the body also proved to be difficult. Stated earlier, it was suspected that the victim could have been a sex worker. Anyone who claimed to have knowledge who the victim was permitted to view the body. At first, she was identified as missing Cincinnati woman, Mrs. Markland, who had been missing since New Year's Eve. The mother of Miss Markland, when viewing the body, broke down in tears, saying that the victim's legs and breast shape matched that of her missing daughter. I'm a little bit skeeved by that comment. However, police in Cincinnati were able to track down Miss Markland, who was alive and working in Cincinnati. Several other people identified the body, but every time the police found the missing person alive and well while following the leads. So yay on that. You found a whole bunch of people that had been reported missing, but they still didn't know who this victim was. Finally, a police officer looked at the victim's shoes. The shoes had been custom made and bore the label Louis Hayes, Greencastle, Indiana, 22-11, 62,458. When detectives investigated Louis Hayes, the sales receipt for the shoes showed that 22-year-old Pearl Bryan had purchased them. When detectives visited the Bryan family in Greencastle with Pearl's belongings, they positively identified them not only as Pearl's, but the green checkered dress had originally belonged to her dead sister. Ugh. Well, they just reused the fabric and made a new outfit. That was actually pretty common. The Bryans also were able to confirm the body without looking at it. Yeah, the stuff was expensive. They were able to confirm the body without describing it or seeing it because they were able to describe the particular webbing found between her toes.
That's an interesting detail.
Yes, it's a very interesting detail. Way too many people knew about Pearl Bryan's body. But yeah, she had just the recessive genetic gene for having webbed toes, and that identified her. So,
yeah.
It was then that several telegrams.
I said, well, that's good. They were able to identify her that way.
Yes. Yay. Actually, really. Yay. I'm glad. It was then that several telegrams between William Wood, Earl's cousin, and Scott Jackson were uncovered. According to Wood, Jackson was enraged when he found out about Pearl's pregnancy and had sent over several concoctions to induce abortion. Whether Pearl took any of them willingly or were secretly given to her is unknown. At the time of her death, she was 5 months pregnant.
Wow.
Detectives apprehended Scott Johnson, who then fingered his roommate, Alonzo Walling, as an accomplice. According to records, police did investigate the area around the active distillery, which is now Bobby Mackey's, and the slaughterhouse for Pearl's head, but it was not found. So they did look, everyone. They did look. During the autopsy, the medical examiner found cocaine in her system. The embalmer also had found a hypodermic needle puncture wound on her left side between her fourth and fifth ribs. It looked as if it had been done while she was still alive. On the witness stand during Jackson's and Walling's trial, the embalmer, W.E. Abbott, said that he believed it was from an injection of ergoline, a chemical used to constrict blood vessels and arteries to limit blood loss during medical procedures, something both Jackson and Walling had access to as dental students. A grim fact, during the autopsy, Pearl's fetus was removed from her body and placed in a jar and preserved with alcohol. It was then put on display at A.F. Goa's Pharmacy at the corner of 5th and York Streets in Newport. The fetus was eventually taken off display. It was either stolen or lost.
Man.
And I was just like, wow, this true crime tale just takes you on twists and turns.
It just gets worse and worse.
Yes.
People are awful.
People are awful. Yes.
God.
This is way worse than I imagined.
Yeah.
Yes, I know. It gets weirder. For 7 weeks after Pearl's death, the Bryan family hoped that her head would be found and returned to them for burial. Her father, Alexander, held out hope that it would be returned, but the head was never found.
Why didn't they want the baby back or the fetus back? I mean, come on.
That I also wondered about. I don't know if they looked and noticed it was missing or what, but it was something I did wonder about. And yeah. I was just like, wow, whomever was at that pharmacy just was
not creepy. Right in the head.
No.
Mm-mm. He probably killed some people. Sorry.
Yeah. Not this murder mystery. That's for later. The Bryans buried Pearl at Forest Hill Cemetery in her white graduation dress and in a pure white casket. The pallbearers were friends from high school, grieving the loss of their young lost friend. Pearl did have a headstone, but morbid curious souvenir hunters kept chipping away at it. The Bryans removed the headstone and only the base remains. Visitors today can still visit Pearl and many leave coins and gifts for her at the grave. So I have also provided the footage of the hangings.
Oh dear.
It's a surprisingly clear photo of the men after their trial a year later. Thousands of people came out to see them, and you can see the crush of humans underneath the scaffolding looking up, waiting for them to drop. As for Scott Jackson and Alonzo Walling, after a swift trial, they were found guilty of murdering Pearl. According to testimony, Jackson and Walling were in downtown Cincinnati with her, drinking at Wallingford's Saloon. Jackson ordered a whiskey for himself and a sarsaparilla for Pearl. It was believed that while at the saloon, Jackson spiked Pearl's drink with cocaine that he had purchased at Colville's drugstore, which was easy to get because everything was full of cocaine at the time. Like, mm-hmm. It was the hot.
The new wonder drug.
Yeah, it was the new wonder drug. Which I'm kind somewhat comforted knowing that Pearl was so out of it, she didn't know what was happening when she died.
God, I hope not. I hope she was unconscious when...
Yeah, that...
Yeah.
Ooh. Walling claimed his innocence to the end, even saying he did not know what happened to poor Pearl's head. Jackson even admitted before going to the gallows that Walling was innocent, which delayed the execution by a few hours. If Jackson admitted guilt, he would save his friend, but he very shortly clammed up, and the only thing he would say is, "I can't say that. It's a trap. I can't say that without admitting I was there." Walling burst out crying, because remember, they're in the same jailhouse, and replied, "Jackson can save my life if he will, but he won't. I have tried in every way to get him to do it, but he just will not. He ought to save me." Walling's girlfriend sent him one last message that said, "Die game," interpreted to mean to die bravely. At 11:30 a.m. on March 20th, 1897, Walling and Jackson were marched up the gallows stairs. This is about a year after the murder. Jackson's last words were, he did this by staring up at the sky. "I only have to say this to say, I'm not guilty of this crime for which I now compelled to pay the penalty of my life." Walling, on the other hand, remained staring at the scaffolding and was visibly trembling. And he said, as his last words were, "Nothing, only that you are taking the life of an innocent man, and I will call upon God to witness the truth of what I say." At 11:40 a.m., the two men fell from the gallows. But the ropes and knots were not tied in such a way to cause immediate death. They were too short, and the knots were put in the wrong place. Whether this was accidental or on purpose, no one will know, but the two of them took 4 minutes to slowly strangle to death in front of thousands of people, their bodies violently thrusting around until life escaped them. They were the last public hangings in Newport.
Yeah, I'd say.
Yeah.
No one wants to see that.
There was too many witnesses. Everyone knew that they did it. It was just...
So, side question, with them being in the jail, is there any, like, records of interrogations and what was said by the two of them of what happened?
That was basically it. There is more deep record looking I could have done. The problem is that some of these newspapers did not digitize well, and reading them was difficult.
Gotcha.
It gave me headaches. So... I can always go back and do an addendum to this if I can find more information for you.
Okay.
But at the moment, with how I was feeling, yeah, it was hard to read.
It'd just be interesting to, after the conversation, saying, you know, he can save my life, but he won't. Like, I
wanted to. They were pretty salty at one another. And they preferred to stay in the jail. Apparently, there was a jailbreak at one point while they were still in the jail. They stayed in their cells because had they left them, they would have been publicly lynched. The people were so mad at them for what they had done to Pearl. So
yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Glad
after that Pearl's happened. Anyway. Yeah. There's a few different times there I've actually read people who'd done something preferred to stay in the jailhouses because they were safer than being out in public. Mm-hmm. This was one of those situations. Yeah. So after Pearl's murder in 1896, at least two skulls were found, thought to be Pearl's. One was found buried in Newport, and the other one washed up on the Ohio River. However, they were both so decomposed that at the time there was no way to tell if either one of them were Pearl's, and no one bothered to save them. To this day, her head has not been found. The leading theory is that either Jackson tossed her head into the Licking or Ohio River, which would have been the easiest thing to do, that catfish would have eaten it, or took it to the dental college to be incinerated, which they had equal access to doing both of those things. A common legend is that Jackson and Walling were Satanists who threw Pearl's head into the well at Bobby Mackey's as a blood sacrifice. Seeing as the distillery was still in operation at the time, I doubt that they would have appreciated a floating head in their water intake. Most likely, this is just an urban legend, and that Pearl, Jackson, and Walling do not have a connection with Bobby Mackey's property.
It seems like the answer is always Satan.
Right?
The time where these particular legends came up was during the Satanic Panic.
Well, yeah.
And that also goes into where I said at the top of the show, it was interesting seeing how the ghost stories changed through the decades, because we've had an eye on Bobby Mackey's since 1978.
Yeah.
And there were interest in Bobby Mackey's and the paranormal things in 1991. That's when they did the talk show circuit. Mm-hmm. Then in the mid-aughts when they were doing Ghost Adventures and the Ghost Paranormal Event Circuit. And then again, more recently with really BuzzFeed's Unsolved, when they went to go interview everyone, it was a very different take than how it had been in previous decades. There may be reasons for that, but we can talk about that later.
Has Bobby Mackey owned it this entire time?
Well, since 1978.
Since 1978.
78, yes.
Okay.
Yes. Give me a moment to drink something.
Okay.
Yeah, I got to keep those vocal cords
mm-hmm.
fresh. Yeah. Okay. There are, of course, the mob ties. Strap in, everyone. It gets weird. More weird.
Woohoo!
Yes. And I provided a photo of the Primrose Country Club. Looks really posh.
Cat, yes. Side note, yes. This can be cut. If I get into the Word document, will that mess up your space?
Where I will just see you dancing around it. And okay. I don't think, as long as you don't delete anything.
Because I just wanted to look at the images is all.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at it right now.
Yeah, one of you is already in there. I guess that's Christina, your wolf.
Yeah, I'm looking at it.
Yeah, and I've seen the cursor dance around and I've been fine.
Okay. I just didn't want you to make you lose your spot.
It doesn't move. It doesn't move. No. You know, it's just I'm using it to read and look at the pictures while she...
Yeah.
But if I scroll, it doesn't mess you up.
No, it won't mess me up. No, it doesn't work like that.
They're just deleting.
Okay.
Yeah, that would mess me up, and then I'd be mad.
Holy motherfuck.
So, the Bluegrass Inn, the Primrose Country Club, and the Latin Quarter. So, with Prohibition starting in 1919, the old distillery closed and sold all their distilling equipment. The building was then torn down, except for the basement, which remained, and all their wonderful tunnels. In 1921, John and Julia Pop purchased the property and built the Bluegrass Inn on the footprint of the distillery. The Bluegrass Inn was a two-story saloon and bowling alley, which sounds really fun, with the Pops living in an apartment above. John Pop was a well-known sketchy guy in Newport and was arrested and fined multiple times for violating the Volstoy Act, which is prohibition. The man kept selling illegal liquor, and the authorities kept finding him, but the fine was only about $500, which when you're selling thousands of dollars worth of liquor a month is easy. You're just like, sure, whatever, man. Here, have $5. Go buy yourself a chocolate malt. In 1929, the punishment for violating the Volstead Act became more severe than just the small fine that I just talked about and a slap on the wrist by local authorities. Now violators were given larger fines, like tens of thousands of dollars, and jail time, sometimes in federal prisons. Because of this, John changed course from making money serving illegal alcohol, which he technically still did, but just not at the same volume, and turned the Bluegrass into an illegal gambling hub. Which, sure, why not? They also employed Albert Red Masterson to run the Bluegrass and to keep John's hands clean. A year later, a fire broke out due to an overheated furnace, and the Pops used the opportunity to insure the building and then just restored it. The following year saw some pretty bad tragedies that changes that happened to the property. In 1930, carpenters working on the building, they were outside of it, had their scaffolding collapse beneath them, resulting in the death of one and one injury. Then Prohibition was repealed in 1933. Huzzah, everyone can drink legally out in the open, but now they had a lot more competition with legal bars and saloons popping up all over Newport and Wilder. And in 1937, another fire broke out and raged through multiple buildings along Licking Pike. The Bluegrass Inn was a total loss this time. They rebuilt it, but in 1941, operating at a loss, John dies and Julia sells the property. I don't know why he died, but Julia sold it to Ernest Buck Braddy, a former underling of George Remus and a former bootlegger, along with Red Masterson and Mel Fernberg. Well, Mel Fernberg didn't do that. He didn't work with Remus, but he had a whole bunch of gambling halls in Cincinnati. They transformed the Bluegrass into the Primrose Country Club. Later that year, Buck Braddy takes over operation of the entire Primrose Country Club from Fernberg. And then Fernberg sues him. He's like, hey! They settled out of court. The Primrose was renovated and business boomed in the early 1940s, but tragedy reared its ugly head again starting in 1943. That year, William Davidson, a singer and gambler known around Newport, brutally beat 21-year-old Paul Goodhue to death in the men's restroom.
Oh, dear.
Yes. Remember that action for later hauntings. In the fall of 1944, E.P. Braddy Jr., who had been the general manager of the Primrose and was Buck's son, dies of tubercular meningitis. Buck Braddy leaves management, I'm just going to call him Buck, of the Primrose to Red and moves to Florida. He sells the Primrose to the Licking Realty Company, who then leased the property to Tom Callahan, and it's at this time that the name was changed to the Latin Quarter. And then they got sued by the actual Latin Quarter in New York City, who Barbara Walters' dad established.
Oh, wow.
I was just like, what? What is this crazy turn? But they basically settled, and the Latin Quarter used its name. So it's not the only time trademark names pop up tonight.
Okay.
August 1st, 1946, Buck returns to Newport and gets into a shootout with Red Masterson on Monmouth Street. Red had become the strong arm for the Cleveland Four, a crime syndicate, while Buck was away making the... which turned the Latin Quarter into a mob location instead of, independent proprietor for casinos and liquor. The result of the shootout left Red being taken to the hospital with multiple gunshot wounds. Buck evaded police at first, but was then found in an outhouse and charged with disturbing the peace. During the trial, George Remus was the character witness on Buck's behalf.
Wow.
But the trial ended with the charges being dropped. Because, the mob. 2 years later, Buck purchases all the property, the business, and all shares of the Latin Quarter back from Licking Realty Company for $100,000. They use the tunnels to bring liquor off the barges on the Licking River. And 6 months later, however, Buck sells everything to the Cleveland Four, who have a rotation of frontmen running the Latin Quarter. Buck takes his $100,000 from them and retires again to Florida.
Only $100,000? That's no profit.
Well he stole it. Was worth more.
Yeah, he got exactly how much he paid for it months earlier. But that's also worth a lot more in today's money.
Well, that's true.
Somebody can calculate it. I'm not doing that right now. And I provided a photo of what is a promotional photo of what the Latin Quarter looked like. So we're basically looking, if you're looking at Bobby Mackey's today, this would have been where the bar is in the foreground and then the stage is in the background. And I think to the right would be what is the casino room, which today is the bull riding area. Yeah. I said, I feel like I live at Bobby Mackey's. just from the amount of content that I have read, I have it mapped out in my brain. It's just,
I was going to say, it's like a tour, a virtual tour.
It's like a tour. Yes. Yeah. In the early 1950s, it was the height of the Latin Quarter, with many Hollywood acts coming to perform there. Acts like Nat King Cole, Ella Fitzgerald, and the Starlet's Chorus line, plus many more. What is now known as the Bull Room was once the casino room with both slot machines and gambling tables in it. And there's actually, they still have it. If you look at the wall, they have the cashier stand. So it has little bars and you would go in there and you would switch out your winnings for cash. And there's a large vault in there that still says made for E.P. Bratty, which was Buck. So I think that's a really neat little bit of crime history that has managed to survive the amount of decades in between that we think that's cool now. But in the 60s, they were like, no, get rid of it. Anyway, the basement is where the mob took cheaters, complete with a small jail room next to the old well. Too bad the Ring hadn't come out in 1990. You scared the shit out of everyone.
Yeah.
Anyway. Just have a guard just right underneath the bars, just making weird gurgly sounds, and then like so many ghost stories would have been created. Anyway, there's enough weirdness that comes out of that well anyhow. Although never confirmed, those found trying to cheat the house found themselves in the basement with a couple of new friends. Some lived to see the next day, and some were never seen of again. Allegedly, their bodies were taken out of the building in oil drums through the tunnel where all the liquor came in, and out onto boats on the Licking River, only to be dumped in the Ohio River somewhere.
Wow.
Complete with cement shoes. In the late 1950s, there was much more, it was much more tough for mob and crime in Newport. In 1955, the Campbell County Police used sledgehammers to break into the club and confiscated the gambling equipment. There was increasing pressure from local businesses and residents against the mob presence in the city, ultimately creating the Committee of 500. The committee successfully ended illegal gambling in Newport, and the big players of Newport gambling went to this new small scene known as Las Vegas.
Woohoo! What stays in what happens in Newport stays in Newport.
Yep. Monmouth Street, everything's quiet there.
Go Cincinnati area!
Yeah. Oh, man. It was fun looking at all the photos of basically what Newport looked like during the 40s and 50s, during that pre-Vegas heyday. And it's very reminiscent of what Vegas looked like, but much more condensed.
Yeah.
And older. Yeah. It had all those old brothels and everything.
Well, and they had the strip clubs forever.
Yeah. Strip clubs forever. In 1964, the Latin Quarter started offering bingo inside the club. Police officers frequently waited at the old TC gas station across the street in case there was a ruckus. In 1965, in failing health, Buck Bratty commits suicide at 84 years old outside his home in Florida.
Was that suicide?
That seems very
sus. At 84?
He was 84. And maybe ill.
If you're tired of living. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, if you're in chronic pain and you're 84 and it's 1965 and there's really not a lot because cocaine's not around anymore. Well, not easily accessible.
I don't know. It's Florida.
That's true. He also had all the party drugs back then. But at any rate, he was found dead in the alleyway behind his house. Oh. So there is wondering if the mob did it.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I'm not so well versed in mob history to really be able to comment further than he was 84 ill and it was Florida in 65. Like,
okay.
Unfortunately is where I'm going to have to leave it. If anybody wants to chime in from our listening audience with more information.
I don't know. I'm picturing a Gus Fring sort of situation.
A what?
That's from Breaking Bad.
Oh, yes. Yes. I know that name. Why do I know that name?
Yeah, now everyone's laughing at me. I was just thinking like, Kat, do not know Breaking Bad?
I was thinking of an Uncle Tio situation. Where
I'm gonna didn't mess with Gus.
Yes, yes.
Never watched the show.
You need to watch it. It's very good.
All right.
It is wonderful. Well, wonderful is not the right word. It's good.
Entertaining in a dark way?
Very dark. Yes. Yes. Okay. Yes.
It'd be wonderful, like Game sounds of Thrones, more magical but... than
and shot beautifully.
Okay.
Yes.
Someday I'll get to watching it. I've also never seen The Sopranos. So
what?
I don't have HBO. So anyway.
I will share my password.
Don't let them know. Okay. In the mid-1970s, the Latin Quarter ceases operations. It becomes the Hard Rock Cafe.
Woo!
Trademark name number two. No relation to the international chain.
Which is now here in Cincinnati now again.
Oh, now again. Yeah. Hopefully not nearly as rough as it was the first time around. This was a rough and dangerous bar. Some people in local comment threads would call it a biker bar. Oh. It was known locally as the Bloody Bucket because the mop bucket was always full of bloody water from mopping up fights.
Oh my God.
The Bloody Bucket.
They really should have gone with that name. That's yes, way seriously. More marketable.
I mean, I know what the Hard Rock Cafe is now. I mean, did they have like well-known bands and stuff playing there at the time? Is that why?
No. I don't know if I assume Hard Rock Cafe was around in the late 70s, but not as well internationally known.
Yeah.
It was like just one flagship place and everyone knew it.
Bloody Bucket. Also a good name for a band, I guess.
That is a good band name.
Yeah.
But yeah. All right. Carl Lawson, who we'll get to know more later, worked at the Hard Rock Cafe as a caretaker and maintenance. He reported that one evening he encountered the apparition of a young woman who told him she was waiting for Robert Randall to come back for her. When he turned around to call the cops on her, she disappeared in the thin air. In 1977, Richard Tonnies, 20, was shot in a skirmish outside the bar. He died 2 months later of his injuries. In January of 1978, Dan Groh, 23, was shot in the neck with a shotgun in an altercation outside the bar. Chief Rob Schneider closes the bar as a public nuisance.
I'd say.
Yeah. This brings us to still 1978, when Bobby Mackey and his wife Janet stumble upon the closed building and our ghost stories really begin. I will note that contrary to what they did state on Ghost Adventures, this place was never abandoned. Never. Since the rebuilding in 1921, there had been consistent businesses up until 1978 in this place.
Yeah, and there's blood and criminal records to prove it.
There are so many deaths on this property, though.
Oh my God.
And it's a lot that are noted because they died outside, and we don't know how many died inside because of the mob. So that's, I think, what adds a layer of mystique to the entire area, because there was such a mob presence and so much of it was hidden and officers looked the other way. So
Shall I keep going,
Christina? We're hitting an hour.
Yeah, let's keep going.
Okay. I mean, now we have hit, after an hour of listening to me yammer on about history, the Bobby Mackey's music world in more modern times. Bobby Mackey has made comments that even before owning the property, he was drawn to it as a younger man. He would pass by the building when it was the Latin Quarter, see all the cars lined up along the road and in the parking lot, and wonder what it was like inside. When he got the chance to purchase the property, he did and sank all of his savings into it. Paranormal activity started to perk up when the couple cleaned up the old building. Janet, who was pregnant at the time with their second child, was getting creeped out around the building. Carl Lawson came to help as a handyman with preparations for the new country music nightclub, having previous experience at the Hard Rock Cafe, or the Bloody Bucket, whichever you want to call it. While sweeping in the old casino room, Janet was struck by a chill and feelings of arms wrapping around her, and a quiet, indistinguishable whisper filled her ears. A ladder began walking itself across the room, nearly falling on Janet before Carl moved her out of harm's way. In another incident, Janet was grabbed yet again by unseen forces in the old kitchen area while Carl was with her. They could hear evil laughing as pots and pans started rattling and then ripping away from their places and shot across the kitchen. Both Janet and Carl got out of the room unhurt but stunned. In yet another instance, and more startling than the other two, Jenna was grabbed by the waist and pulled up into the air before being flung down the staircase leading to the second floor apartment. As she states in her 1991 interview on Jerry Springer, "I was upstairs checking around, making sure everything was, you know, getting prepared to open, as someone grabbed me around the waist. It was so much pressure and force that I could not get loose, so I was picked up and carried almost to the door to where you go down the stairs and dropped on the floor. And then I got loose from it somehow and went to the top of the steps and fell down again. I was trying to scream out, but I couldn't." She goes on to say, "I was at the bottom and on my knees when I heard a voice say, 'Get out, get out.'" The experience forced Janet into premature labor and delivering her daughter 3 months early the following day. The baby survived, good news, and she now has a grown family of her own.
Oh my god.
Yay.
Wow, 3 months early.
Is Woo-hoo!
Early.
It's very great. Early.
It's very early.
But I'm glad baby was okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. I will note that a lot of media doesn't actually say what happened to Janet or the baby after the incident. They just cut it off there. And I was super worried until I actually watched the Jerry Springer interview and she confirms that she were fine. And unfortunately later, I can confirm that everyone's okay, but yeah. Okay. Shortly before the opening of the nightclub, a fire broke out and destroyed a wing of the building that formerly housed staff and held a private poker room. The cause of the fire was never determined. It worries me that this place magically catches on fire quite frequently.
Hmm. Yeah, is this the third time?
Actually, it's the fourth. I omitted another fire because it wasn't really... It was an interesting footnote, but I was just like, I don't know. Do you want to hear it? It's from the 1800s. So this is the end of episode part one. I almost wanted to say, now you can flip your disc to the second.
Flip the disc from the yeah.
Please insert disc one. Thank you everyone for being with us during the history of Bobby Mackey's, the prehistory of Bobby Mackey's, shall we call it that?
Yes, I think that's what it is.
Yes, the prehistory of Bobby Mackey's, giving all the wonderful context to the hauntings that we're going to hear about in episode two, or part two. There we go. It's been a long night. We've done a lot of history and research, and thank you for sticking with us for really 100 episodes and now 101 episodes.
Yes. So, yes. All right.
For Christina, Jen, and myself, good night and stay spooky and happy spooktacular.
Good night. Bye-bye.